and we have no more control over our destiny than a leaf does that is being carried away by the wind. You can see then the very helpless and hopeless condition that man's in when he allows sin to come in. And this is what had happened to these people from Israel, from Judea, that God had caused to be carried away into captivity. Sin had come in, and they were completely helpless. Here they were in captivity, completely severed from their home country, and it was because of this sin. So our iniquities, like the wind, have taken us away. Verse 7, "And there is none that calleth upon thy name." Now what he's saying here is, what they're saying here is that the whole nation is corrupt. The gist, the tendency of the whole nation was to be turned away from God, and for none of them to call upon the name of God. Now they were dull when it came to appreciating God. They were looking to other things. They were too busy. They were too involved. They had too many other diversions to call upon the name of God. And then on top of that, they had too many things that were false gods that were interfering with their ability to recognize and to truly worship the living God. So it says, "There is none that calleth upon thy name, that stirreth up himself to take hold of thee." Now the picture here is that stirreth up himself is for one to awake from sleep. They were sleeping. They were in a state of stupor, a slumber, and they couldn't stir themselves up enough to take hold of God. Now, this reminds me of a time in which a person has been sleeping all night and it comes time to get up, and it's so difficult to get up, so hard to crawl out of the bed for some people. And they just want to keep laying there and keep sleeping, and it's so relaxing and so peaceful just to lay there and do nothing but sleep, and to close your eyes and to go into a state of slumber and semi-consciousness or unconsciousness and maybe dream. This is the condition people are in whenever they're not aware of God. They are sleeping, and they are not aware of God. They're not turning to God. So there are none that stirreth up himself to take hold of thee. And this phrase, to take hold of thee, simply means to seek strength in God. They're not holding on to God. They're not taking hold of God or coming a part of God or getting their strength from God. They won't lay there and sleep. And we see then that what a person has to do, or what a people have to do in order to please God, is to wake up, to stir themselves up, to become aroused enough that they are provoked, they are prodded, they are stimulated to do something. They're stirred up, they are awakened, and they take hold of God. They look to God for a source of strength and sustenance and comfort, and they hang on to God. They will not let God get away. But these people hadn't done this. None that calleth upon thy name, that stirreth up himself to take hold of thee. Now, when you're in this condition, you are so lukewarm, you are so lazy, you're so sleepy, you are so unaware and unconscionable about the things of God, you're going to find yourself in a state of Babylonian captivity. Now, not the old Chaldeans, but it's going to be the modern Babylon, which is the apostate church, and all of the harlots that are the offspring of this apostate church, which have taken in all of these old relics from idolatry in times past. You're going to find yourself in Babylonian captivity simply because you have not stirred yourself up and taken hold of God. He goes on in verse 7, "For thou hast hid thy face from us and hast consumed us because of our iniquities." Now this phrase, consumed us, means that you've melted us. And it's all because of these sins, because of our iniquities. You have hid your face from us and hast consumed us. God has really apparently turned away from them, hid his face from them, not found it desirable to associate with them, to meet with them, to be truly their God while in this state of having turned away from God. Because of our iniquities. And here again we see exactly what the problem is. In verse 5 he says, "For we have sinned." Here in verse 7 he says, "Because of our iniquities." Now it doesn't take a very smart person to realize then what can happen to us. What we have to do to have God turn away from us. What is it? Sin. Sin. Be guilty of these iniquities. Of these deeds that are contrary to God's will. That's all it required. All that is required to disqualify us from having God's presence. Simply be guilty of the things that God is displeased with. So in verse 8, they make a very ardent appeal to God. "But now, O Lord, thou art our Father. We are the clay, and thou our potter, and we all are the work of thy hand." This verse is appealing to God to remember them as his children, and to remember that he is their father, that he has made them promises in the past, that he has assumed the posture of a father to them, and that really and truly they are a people that he's taken from nothing and he's formed them. They are actually the clay, and he is the potter. He has made them what they are. And so the verse concludes, "We are all the work of thy hand." Now this is designed to cause God to remember and to have a tender feeling for them. There's no other people in the world that's had the relationship with God that they have had. He did give them the law and the promises, and he did give them the articles of worship, the priesthood, and the temple. He gave them the land of Canaan. And so they're asking him to remember these things, to know these things, and to show mercy on them. And to turn and again to treat them as his children and again to be their father. The verse has some very interesting thought connected with this. The fact that we are the clay and God is our potter implies that that God has the power to mold and to make and to shape us into whatever manner he wants us to be. And we have some other references to this in the Bible that we'd like to turn to and read rather briefly and see the images that are given there. First of all, in Isaiah 45, verse 9. Isaiah 45, verse 9. "Woe unto him that striveth with his maker. Let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say to him that fashioneth it, What makest thou? Or thy work? He hath no hands." And this verse is simply, affirming the fact that these people are the clay and God is the potter. And that the clay has no right, or the pot has no right, to strive with the one who's made it. And that's the position we're in. Whenever we become opposed to God, or we start arguing with God, or striving with God, we're the clay. Well, the pot that he has made the way he wants it to be made, and we have no right to argue with him or to strive with him. "Woe to him that striveth with his maker. Let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth." Now, the potsherds are the little fragments of pottery that have been broken off. And that's really what we are. We're just a fragment. And so if we're going to strive with anything, we'd have to find another thing that's equal to us, another potsherd of the earth to strive with, not the potter, not the one who is the maker. "Shall the clay say to him that fashioneth it, What makest thou? Or thy work, he hath no hands." Do we have a right to criticize God for what he's done? Why, he didn't have to give us life at all. He didn't have to even give us a body. He didn't have to give us an existence even. And shall we complain to him and about him because he's done this to us? Ask him, What are you making? Why have you done this? We have no right to do this. Because if he had enough intelligence and enough power to do what he has done and to give us this existence, then certainly he has enough intelligence to do the thing that is right and proper so far as we're concerned. Again, we'd like to turn and read another verse from Romans 9, verses 20 and 21. Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, Why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor? There again showing that we have no power to reply against God or to question God or to call God into judgment because of what he's done. We're the clay. We're the thing that's formed. We have no right to say to him that formed us, Why hast thou made me thus? The potter has power over the clay. He does with it what he wants to. If he doesn't, then he's not a potter. But this verse and these passages depict God as being a potter, one that has power over us. And so, this verse 8 then of Isaiah 64, We are the clay, and thou our potter, and we're all the work of thy hand. So this is a tender plea to God to remember then the true relationship that they have had and wish to reestablish with God. He's the maker, they're the clay. He's the potter, they're the pot. Verse 9, Be not wroth very sore, O Lord, neither remember iniquity forever. Behold, see, we beseech thee, we are all thy people. Simply asking God here not to be angry, not to be one who remembers iniquity forever. Yes, we've been guilty of iniquity. Our iniquities have separated us from you. Our iniquities have put us in this terrible condition of captivity. But don't remember this iniquity forever. Do not continue to be angry for an overly long period of time. See, we beseech thee, we are thy people. We're trying to reestablish contact with you as our God. We're trying to reestablish our relationship. We are thy people, the only people that you've ever had, really. We want to continue to be thy people. Verse 10. Thy holy cities are a wilderness. Zion is a wilderness. Jerusalem a desolation. Reminding God of the very depraved state that they're in. Our holy cities. This would really probably refer to the cities in Judea. Some people want to translate this and say that it means the different divisions of the one city of Jerusalem when he says thy holy cities, but it's talking about all the cities in Judea. That would be the context. Thy holy cities are a wilderness, and the word wilderness here simply means uninhabited. They're not inhabited any longer. Zion is a wilderness. Zion is the holy area of Jerusalem. It no longer has the worship. It no longer has the connotation of being the center around which God meets his people and gives forth his blessings. It's a wilderness now. It's not inhabited any longer. Jerusalem is a desolation. And when we think of this description here, we have to realize that it was spoken towards the close of the Babylonian captivity. And Jerusalem had been in a state of ruin for 70-some-odd years, or approximately 70 years. A description of this is given over in 2 Chronicles 36, and let's turn to that and read it just a minute. In 2 Chronicles 36, beginning with the 16th verse and reading down through the 21st verse, we have an account given of the condition of the people in Judea and some of the things that brought about their overthrow, and then how actually they were treated by the Babylonians or the Chaldeans as they came in. Verse 16, But they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young men or maiden, old man, or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. and they burnt the house of God, and brake down the wall of Jerusalem, and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire, and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. As we read that passage, we can see then some of the true meaning of this verse 10. The holy cities are a wilderness, Zion is a wilderness, and Jerusalem is a desolation. That it had been in ruin for some 70 years. They were not inhabited. They no longer were even a semblance to what they had formerly been. And the people are making a plea to God to take note of this. Again, in verse 11, he further describes this. Our holy and our beautiful house, where our fathers praised thee, is burned up with fire, and all our pleasant things are laid waste. Now this house he's talking about here is the temple, our holy and our beautiful house. It was a holy house because it was there that the worship of God was conducted, there that God met with the priest, there that the atonement was made. It was a holy house because of the great things of God that were done there. And a beautiful house, beautiful because of the way it was made, the magnificence of its structure. So he says, our holy and beautiful house, where our fathers praised thee. Now this gave an added love and yearning for this place, because it was a place where our fathers praised thee. I haven't had the experience, and probably not very many that are listening to me now have had this experience, but if we worshipped in a place that was supposed to be a holy place, and that God had intended for it to be a holy place, and then on top of that, our fathers had also worshipped there for generations in the past, and they'd used the same things that we were using, and seen the same things that we were seeing, and been in the identical spot, and there they had worshipped God, then it would have an added value to us, because our fathers had worshipped, our fathers had praised thee. And this is what the temple was. It was a place where generation after generation they had pleased and praised God. And when a man or a woman went there, they could say, well, my fathers, my mother, my ancestors were here in this same place, and they also did what I'm doing now. And it had a deeper significance to them than any other place could have. So this place, the holy and beautiful house where our fathers praised thee, is burned up with fire. As we read in 2 Chronicles 36, it had been destroyed with fire, been burned up, and all our pleasant things are laid waste. And as we think of this phrase, our pleasant things, it's just talking about their homes and their cities. If they could even imagine what they were like, well, their homes would not be any semblance to what they were before they were taken away. The walls of the cities had been knocked down. The streets that they were so familiar with walking up and down and using were grown up with grass and weeds. The place was uninhabitable. There was probably no drinkable water. There was no protection from the elements. The roofs had caved in. The thing had been sacked. There was nothing of value that was left. Our pleasant things are laid waste. Anything that they held dear to their heart in the way of a earthly attachment or earthly possession was completely taken away from them. You see what total punishment God put these people through. They had nothing to come home to. Today, usually we think of a person who is taken away to prison, or some kind of captivity. If he is allowed to be free, then he has a home to return to. His home hasn't been destroyed. Only he has been bothered. But these people not only were taken into captivity, but the home that they left was completely, totally destroyed. They were laid waste. They no longer existed as they knew them. And that's the picture they're painting here to God, and part of their plea to God. God, you've done all these things to us. Now, the punishment is sufficient. We want to be thy people. We want you to be our father. We want you to come back to us. We want you to release us. We want you to take revenge on your enemies. Verse 12. In view of these things now, wilt thou refrain thyself for these things, O Lord? That is, are you going to withhold yourself? Are you going to keep yourself away from us longer? Or do you plan to never come back? Are you going to withhold yourselves in view of all that's happened? And the question is implying that surely you can't stay away forever, O God. Surely you can't just completely forget about us. You can't withhold yourself. Wilt thou hold thy peace and afflict us very sore? Are you going to hold your peace and just never intervene, never return, never make yourself known, completely stay hidden, withhold thy peace and afflict us very sore, continue to have us afflicted, an affliction that has no end? As it said in verse 9, be not wroth very sore. That is for an unreasonable amount of time. And here, afflict us very sore. Afflict us beyond what is reasonable, what is effective. And truly, this punishment had been effective. They were now ready at the end of their captivity to go back and to serve God. And idolatry was no longer a very significant problem among them, because we do not even have it mentioned after they got back out of captivity. It was a very effective punishment and chastisement, and they did make a correction. So this verse 12 is asking God these questions. Are you going to hold thy peace and afflict us very sore? Are you going to refrain yourself for these things, O Lord? Even implying, how can you continue to wait much longer in view of all that's happened? And this simply shows that when a person or when a people have been sufficiently chastised for a sin, rather than to cause bitterness, rather than to cause them to turn away from God, rather than to cause them to continue in their sin, they're going to turn to God. They're going to appeal to Him with all the tender emotions and all of the remembrances that they can muster, so that God then will truly realize that they have repented and that they truly are the people of God, and they want to reestablish that relationship that goes along with it. But we're going to conclude at that point. Next time then, Lord willing, to begin with chapter 65. Thank you.